This is Steve Sherlock with another Franklin Matters radio show. This session of the radio show shares part of the Franklin Mass School Committee meeting held on Tuesday, February 8, 2022. The meeting was conducted in a hybrid format. All of the school committee members were in the council chambers, along with some of the public. Some members of the public and school personnel participated via conference bridge, all to adhere to the social distance requirements of this pandemic period. I split the three-hour meeting into three logical segments. The first segment covers the opening, citizens' comments, and superintendent's report, approximately 35 minutes. The second segment covers the update on diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts around the district, including the Q&A and commentary at the end of the presentation. This goes approximately an hour and 53 minutes. Third covers the discussion action items, discussion-only items, consent agenda, and then the school committee votes to enter executive session, not to return to open meeting, approximately 32 minutes. Links to the meeting agenda and associated documents released for this meeting are included in the show notes. The link to my notes taken during the meeting is also provided. Let's listen to this segment of the school committee meeting, February 8, 2022.
Thank you very much, Dr. Hearn.
Thank you.
All right, next we have guests and presentations.
Thank you. So we're gonna get situated here because I've got a couple of different folks presenting with me. In the room, we are joined by Principal Sarah Klim from the Jefferson Elementary School and Assistant Superintendent Lucas DeGeer and Director of Student Services Paula Morano will also be presenting. And then as panelists on the webinar this evening, we have Dr. Linda Ashley, who is our Director of Curriculum for ELA and Social Studies at the Spirit Central Office. We have Josh Hanna, the Franklin High School Principal. And we have Craig Williams, Remington Middle School Principal, and Kristen Latender-Smith. She is our Director of Health and Wellness for the district. And I'm incredibly grateful for their time this evening in co-presenting this presentation on Franklin Public Schools Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Efforts. I'm going to grab my ticket, everybody's in place. I'm going to kick us off and start. This presentation, I think, was initiated by the school committee in the workshop in the summer, kind of specifically requesting and asking for a presentation on our diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts. And I will say, I think it's one of the hardest presentations I've ever put together in 10 years as a central office administrator, and I've been building administrator before that since 2006. In part because I guess I'm proud to share just how systemic our work is. And I felt that over the past several weeks in putting this together, every time I visited a school, I wanted to add a new story or a new observation that I was making about what I was seeing in the classroom. But I also want to be really careful and be sure to convey to our community that it is with great humility that I also make this presentation, or we also make this presentation to you. There is a lot of listening and learning that we do, and reflecting on the actions and the steps that we take. And I'm not going to pretend that we have it all right, but we are certainly trying to put our best feet forward to listen, learn, act, and reflect for the betterment of all students in the Franklin Public Schools. So, without further ado, I just want to share a little bit about how we approach diversity, equity, and inclusion in the Franklin Public Schools. And I would consider our work as like a Venn diagram. So much of what you'll hear tonight are school-based efforts happening on behalf of administrators, faculty, staff, families, and students. And we also have a committee. The Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Committee has been in place since last year. Last year we had about 60 members, this year we have over 40 administrators, students, and faculty and staff. We all have a common effort collectively to affirm diversity, promote equity, and foster inclusion. And I think what you'll hear tonight is mostly some things that are happening naturally in our school-based efforts aligned with school improvement and district improvement. The Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Committee is certainly active, And I anticipate bringing back some outcomes from that committee at the end of the year as part of the district improvement plan update. So this next slide, I think, is an important foundation and basis for our work, which is what we are striving to do in being a culturally proficient school district. And these notes came from a professional development session that we had for the entire district in September of 2020 with Khalees Warnham of KW Diversity. And so with this foundation, we strive to take the time to listen to who students say they are and what their needs are. Too often the needs or the needs of the school system take precedence. So we are looking to uplift and amplify student voice. Achievement, outcome, and opportunity gaps were present before we arrived, but we may not ignore them. And as educators, we must be willing to examine our individual and collective values, behaviors, policies, and practices of our district as we work towards becoming culturally proficient. The Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Committee began their work by crafting an equity statement and defining diversity, equity, and inclusion for the district. And a highlight related to diversity is that we aim to take a broad approach to what diversity means. Identities, thoughts, ideas, perspectives, and values, including the fluidity that may exist, involving race, ethnicity, gender identity or expression, sexual orientation, socioeconomic status, age, religious beliefs, culture, national origin, disability, and cognitive styles. So in this presentation, when we share our examples with you, I think we're aiming to touch upon many of these different areas of diversity and identity. And so you'll see examples across multiple aspects here. In terms of equity, this is not an all-encompassing definition, but one of the things that we think is important is that equity involves providing opportunities and reducing barriers so that each student is able to attain the attributes of Franklin's portrait of a graduate. And working towards inclusion is working towards that idea of belonging, which means that we are authentically seeking out, valuing, and respecting input of all. I thought it important to ground this work in Franklin's Portrait of a Graduate. These are some of the descriptors that we've included for all students in the Franklin Public Schools to be working towards, demonstrating social awareness through inclusivity and the consideration of various perspectives, analyzes, evaluates, and synthesizes relevant information from multiple perspectives, varied viewpoints and sources, listens with an open mind and embraces a respectful, inclusive, and culturally aware approach, and identifies and analyzes problems from multiple perspectives. And those problems could be social problems that vary from multiple perspectives. Covered throughout our presentation, you'll see a couple of quotes, but I liked this one, except maybe the last word I would change. Inclusive education seeks to address the learning needs of all children with a specific focus on those who are vulnerable to marginalization and exclusion. Therefore, the goal is to promote opportunities for all children to participate and be treated. This is equally and probably substitute equitably, but it is not my goal. So I want to ground this work in our students and share a little bit about the demographics of students in Franklin Public Schools. Again, I want to be clear that this work is designed to instill those skills that I just described from the Portrait of a Graduate in each and every child. We may have a particular focus on reducing barriers and including students who may have historically been marginalized. This is important work for each and every child in the Franklin Public Schools in order for us to live in an interdependent and empathetic society. So first, starting out with a few statistics regarding race and ethnicity. We are continuing to be a predominantly white student body, although that is changing a little bit over time. And we have seen more students identifying as a person of color with 17.1% in the current DESE data. And that is a contrast to the percent of faculty and staff at 1.7 by a whole order of magnitude. This will come up a bit later when we talk about efforts related to diversifying the educator workforce and the value that exists, research-based value that exists when a student has a faculty and staff member that they identify with and the outcomes related to student learning. We are seeing, particularly this year, a big increase in the number of English learners we have in the district. So although our overall population has gone down in the past decade, we've seen a 50% increase in English learners. We were about 60 or so English learners back in 2012, and we currently have 95 English learners in our district this year. The other thing that I would note is our English learners, we have more students who have an interrupted formal education or are newcomers. And so they have lower proficiency levels of English. In 2019-2020, the Department of Education collected data about students identifying as non-binary. And in that year, we had 2 students. And for this year, we have 9 students identifying as non-binary in the district. If you looked at the Department of Ed's data on economics, it is very hard to draw some longitudinal comparisons because the way in which they calculate low income or low SES has changed over time. But looking at free and reduced lunch might be something that gives us a little bit of a longitudinal comparison. And we're currently have 16% of our students identified as qualifying for free and reduced lunch. And that number has doubled roughly in the last decade. That percentage has doubled roughly in the last decade. At the same time, I'll just remind you that the overall population has increased. And students with disabilities, we're currently at 18.4%, which is right around the state average. It is up a little bit from a few years ago, but has been stable in terms of percentage in a couple of years. What I would note about trends there is that we're seeing increased prevalence of increased intensive student needs when we're talking about students with disabilities. And so you've heard over time kind of help you expand in some of our specialized programs and services accordingly. So given that framework of the portrait of a graduate, focusing on all of our students, but also taking a look at trends in our demographics, we've got some selected areas of focus for you this evening. Want to talk a little bit about the efforts that the school committee has taken, your leadership and the leadership of school committees in the past, in terms of setting equitable policies. We'll talk a bit about some highlights related to professional development. Want to spend some time in a few key areas related to curriculum and instruction. We'll talk about school culture in terms of proactive things that are going on to promote a positive school culture. We'll talk about reactive things, including responding to bias-based incidents, and then district supports. So a couple highlights related to school committee leadership. In the past 3 years or so, there have been a number of school committee resolutions adopted that are related to more equitable and inclusive learning experiences. I think the one that maybe resonates the most is a anti-racism resolution that was adopted in the summer of 2020. And I say that because this work has been, and I'll share a little bit more on another slide, this work has been underway for quite some time. But the events of George Floyd's murder that May and that summer really fomented and accelerated the work, and the school committee adopted the resolution. Later that fall, and the slate of resolutions that came forward, the school committee also supported a resolution towards equity for sexual orientation of LGBTQ+ students, teachers, and staff. This most recent fall, MASC as an organization, the resolution committee put forward, and the school committee supported a resolution on the ban of Native American mascots, support on the use of restorative justice practices over zero tolerance policies, and supporting equity through access to free broadband, largely in rural parts of Massachusetts. A resolution pertaining to educator diversity and professional licensure was supported in the fall of 19. A resolution related to the access of menstrual products was also supported at that time, and resolutions related to universal pre-K and the impact of poverty on children was also supported at that time. So I think you can see through these resolutions, which lead to advocacy, you kind of an overall support both of this committee as well as MASC and other committees in the Commonwealth towards equity. I can't give the entire history of this work, and there are certainly people on this call who have been in the district prior to my arrival, but my perspective in terms of coming in as superintendent when I arrived in 2017, cultural proficiency has been a discrete initiative under instruction in the school's improvement plan, which was something that had been in place for a couple of years prior to my arrival. Working with the school committee and the administrative team, we took cultural proficiency and placed it as an overarching goal through which the other goals were viewed rather than a discrete initiative in just one area. And I think in 2020, we really took a closer look and identified some specific initiatives with a DEI lens. Also, I think shaping this from leadership from the top, from the school committee, are also some policies and some practices that want to make sure everybody is aware of. In recent years, we revised the financial assistance policy to broaden access to financial assistance beyond free and reduced lunch in order to support families who need that. The dress code policy was examined in 2018 to provide for a more inclusive school dress code. Similarly, homework policy was reviewed around that time with a recognition that students don't have the same types of supports for homework, and so wanting to create a policy that created a level playing field around homework. We've revised policies related to educational opportunities for homeless students, students of military families, and children in foster care. And as we go through the policy manual, there's a very deliberate process of making sure that it is being revised for gender neutrality with the changing of pronouns, among other language that they define. Contracts are being looked at with updated anti-bias language. The word grandfather, for example, I think has a negative history, and so that is something that we're looking for alternatives to, as well as revising contracts for gender neutrality. Based on feedback and input from a parent, we revised our enrollment forms to be inclusive of all families. They now say parent one, parent two, or parent, I should say parent guardian one, parent guardian two, in recognition that families can be comprised of all sorts of adults supporting children. We have facilitated access to interpreters for visitors to our school offices, and our new online enrollment, which was a product of the pandemic, expands access in multiple languages. This is a brief chance for me to catch my breath and show a picture. But this is the entryway of our office, where we have a display your right to an interpreter and just make it easy for folks to come in and enroll children. I think it'd be really hard to cover all of the professional development that's going on in the district, but we are working towards professional development in a multitude of ways, and we'll highlight several examples for you. Similar to how I started with the Calise Warnham Foundation of a Culturally Proficient District, Calise also talks about indicators of a culturally proficient teacher. A culturally proficient teacher self-reflects and asks, what are my cultural values? How do my values shape the way I teach, evaluate, and understand others? She suggests that we study our students and our staff, learning who they are, how do their cultural values shape their learning, showing that we value their culture and creating entry points for their culture, having an ability and willingness to have difficult conversations, asking curious questions and believing their reality, and articulating and living the vision. Our faculty are the vision in motion, embodying the articulated culturally proficient vision of the district, and practice and develop the rules and traditions that encourage cultural proficiency. So this was again shared at the beginning of 2020 with our faculty and staff. And I love going to buildings and hearing stories about ways in which they are seeking to know about their students and learn more about them. In addition to having some PD with Dr. Warner, we have had professional development locally facilitated in the district by a couple of different people from Learning for Justice. They have a program called Speak Up at School. We have held sessions for all district faculty and staff. We have held sessions at New Teacher Orientation, and there is some follow-up being done in faculties, smaller groups, individual faculties, for example. Speak Up at School is a way to interrupt microaggressions in some language around that. We have had, and you'll hear more tonight, about our work with LGBTQ plus Safe Schools, which is a program through DESE, as well as Children's Friend, that has worked with some of our elementary faculty and staff, where a student, to support the student, the family, all children, and the faculty and staff, with a student transitioning their gender. And counselors have attended webinars on non-discrimination on the basis of gender identity. We have an effort to incorporate DEI into curriculum units, and so that is part of professional development. We've engaged student voice in some of our professional development to listen from our students. And you'll hear a little bit more about the high school resource group tonight. And many of our faculty and staff at the building level have been through formal, informed, trauma-informed care training. And this is just a graphic to kind of anchor the Speak Up at School and giving teachers language around interrupting the microaggression, questioning it, educating around it, or echoing what another upstander might say. That's a framework that we have been practicing. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to a few folks to talk a little bit more specifically about curriculum and instruction. And I think we have a nice quote that, I don't know if Ms. Clam or Dr. Ashley picked it, but we have a quote to anchor this.
Dr. Ashley picked it, but she asked me to read it. Literature transforms human experience and reflects it back to us, and in that reflection, we can see our own lives and experiences as part of the larger human experience. And there are some examples of literature here for you tonight, just to show a little bit about what we're talking about that larger human experience. One focus for a very long time now in all of our schools is expanding the collections in our classrooms, our classroom libraries, and then our school libraries. There's an expression that's being used a lot in education to provide children with windows, mirrors, and doors. And so we're talking about giving them opportunities to look through the windows and peek in on those who are living lives that are different from theirs in a lot of different ways. Providing them mirrors to see themselves reflected back in the literature that they're experiencing. And also experiencing doors into other cultures, other religions, other family structures, other types of homes that they might not be as familiar with. And really looking for books that provide an authentic voice. So for example, one thing that you're seeing a lot of right now in children's publishing is Native American authors telling their stories. Neil Frybert is an example of that that I brought with me tonight. And so we're seeing a lot of that. We're seeing a lot of books reflecting a lot of different individuals with disabilities. And so I always say that you can, you know, anything you need to talk about with a child, you can find it in a book, and that's really true. You know, we talk a lot about food insecurity. Jefferson and all of our schools do food drives with the Franklin Food Pantry. There's books about soup kitchens. You know, there's books, as I said, about different disabilities. So we have a book like Just Ask that features character, a different character on every page, telling about the challenge that they might face, whether that's with diabetes, asthma, dyslexia, being in a wheelchair. A lot of students might know someone with asthma, but they might not know that much about it. So this book provides a window to learn a little bit more about that. And just in general, we're seeing books that are telling stories that feature characters that represent a much more global view. So a book like All Are Welcome, which is a great story for building community in your classroom and features so many different characters, characters in wheelchairs and characters coming from all different places. So that's the type of thing that we have been looking for a long time to increase our classroom libraries and continue to do so. And that's just an example for the elementary ECDC, but it's going on at our middle schools and high schools as well.
Next up, Dr. Ashley is going to talk a bit about some of our work related to challenging tests and PD.
Thank you, Dr. Hearn, and thank you, Ms. Clay. Not only is Sarah an outstanding principal, but she's also had that outstanding literacy background that we truly value so much on our administrative team. So this year, our grade 8 teachers participated in professional development through Primary Source, which is a wonderful professional development provider that many surrounding districts rely on. We focused on helping teachers facilitate discussions about challenging topics, such as inequality, prejudice, and oppression. We really wanted the teachers to feel supported in meeting the curriculum demands at the eighth grade level. They really appreciated that time to collaborate, to get together, and to have some guidance from an outside source who has a lot of expertise in this area. So one of the things the eighth grade teachers really talked a lot about was creating a safe and respectful classroom community to really facilitate meaningful engagement. So really creating that safe community has to come first before you can read literature, understand literature, and really look at things from a variety of perspectives, and really teaching the students and having them practice how to have respectful and appropriate dialogue and really listening to each other's voices and different opinions. We talked about creating ground rules as a class to support these honest discussions and a safe place to share perspectives. So before literature would get taught, and really at the beginning of the year is really to set up that classroom community. And then we talked about some ideas for how teachers can kind of bring out the discussion in the kids that might be quiet or might have opinions, but be a little bit reluctant at that eighth grade level to talk about what they're feeling and thinking. So we talk a lot about using reflective questions, encouraging writing or journaling. You know, you don't have to say it out loud, but you can still participate and communicate with your teacher about your thoughts and feelings in writing. So I think teachers, we have still a lot more to do, but the teachers did appreciate this as a start. We do send letters to parents and guardians of students reading books that include mature themes or our language so that parents can process text with students at home as well as under the guidance of their trained teachers at school. So we send home letters when we're reading books such as The Bluest Eye or To Kill a Mockingbird, which will help mature themes, language, and some challenging topics. So some people wonder why do we use text and difficult material in our classrooms, but it's important for our students to encounter different contexts so they have the opportunity to understand other human experiences. We know that literature really leads to deep and meaningful conversations, topics such as racism, gender roles, growing up, having empathy, and identity. So as we said, the teachers take talking about literature very seriously. They guide groups. Students aren't just given a book and saying, go read it, we'll talk about it later. They really guide the literature discussions in that core group to really support students' understanding of thinking and discussions. And then we encourage parents to, even if they can't read along with the text as the students are reading, that they give, they can support their students at home in processing material if they have any questions.
We're joined tonight by Kristen Letender-Smith, who is our Director of Health and Wellness, and this department has been doing quite a bit of work related to their health and wellness curriculum for a couple of years now, and Kristen's going to share more with you.
Thank you, Sarah, and thank you to the Franklin School Committee for inviting me in tonight to share what we've been working on. Approximately 5 years ago, we did a major curriculum review in our K-12 discipline. And as Sarah mentioned, we've been doing a lot of listening and learning throughout that time. I also belong to the Cities and Towns Administrators Health and Physical Education Directors Group, in which I learn a lot and see what's going on in other towns in Massachusetts related to our discipline. So we've made a lot of curriculum revisions based on feedback that we've gotten from students, from families, and from best practices in the field from other experts. Our staff participated, as Sarah mentioned before, in the DESE Safe Schools training in 2017, along with our guidance and adjustment counseling staff. And since then, we've really been trying to use gender-inclusive language in all of the lessons that we teach. The biggest change within our curriculum has been gender-inclusive human growth and development lessons, which we implemented in 2019. And that falls within grades 4 through 10 within our district. And the focus really is medical and looking at the science and biology behind all the body changes that we all go through. We know that we all change throughout the life cycle, and that's normal with our hormones and physical characteristics and all of those things, and it's nothing to be ashamed of. So we also try to normalize those changes with in our classrooms and within our curriculum. So we know that students don't feel alone, and some of those changes are social changes, emotional changes, in addition to the physical changes that they may experience through puberty. And this is also the type of education that has been linked to a reduction in gender-based violence in some global studies. It's also nice to see that our work has been supported by the Mass Senate bill from 2020 with the use of gender-inclusive language and gender education and consent within our lessons. We've included multicultural products in our hygiene lessons at the elementary school. We started to use racially diverse CPR mannequins at the high school when we teach CPR, and have included inclusive classroom posters across our K-12 classrooms. We've also developed new lessons on consent and revisions to other lessons that we had related to healthy relationships and respect and bullying within our K-12 curriculum. And within the physical education classroom, we focused on sports and games from around the world, including those related to the Olympics, Paralympics, Special Olympics, and have started to teach more of the history behind some of the units that we teach, including that tennis originated in France, chukball is a form of handball that originated in Switzerland, soccer and the World Cup and was created in China, among other sports created in the United States. So we try to globalize what our students are learning.
Thank you, Kristen. Dr. Arshi is going to talk a little bit about the approach in social studies.
So in 2018, they're not new anymore, but it feels like they're new because of the pandemic. But in 2018, the new History and Social Studies frameworks came out from DESE. And so we're we're aligned to these standards. And our teachers not only use the standards as far as the curriculum and the scope and sequence, but there's also some really important guiding principles in the frameworks that we talk about often. So related to diversity, equity, inclusion, the guiding principles really incorporate diverse perspectives and tell the histories of individuals and groups, which is a really important part of teaching history and social studies. The frameworks and the curriculum will honor life stories while acknowledging our own ongoing struggle to achieve a more perfect union. So really looking at honoring history, but looking to see the perspectives and how students can relate it to their own lives and to the future. Some examples of the frameworks is in first grade, students learn about the ways in which people in the United States are both unified and diverse, and how people from different parts of the world have different customs. And we'll talk a little bit about that later, but really celebrating lots of different holidays and lots of different cultures was really important to the elementary experience. In grade five, for example, students learn about slavery, the early United States, and how enslaved people sought their freedom. And then they learn up into the Civil Rights Movement and how the Civil Rights Movement challenged the oppression of African Americans. And then moving up to middle school and high school, teachers include discussions of current events, and they really ground their discussions and teaching through historical, geographical, social, and economic contexts. So really weaving all those together, as you can see the progression of how students can understand different perspectives and different contexts as they mature. Our civics project are really coming along. In 2018, Governor Baker signed an act to promote and enhance civic engagement, which included student-led civics projects. So our civics projects are done in eighth grade, and then some of them are continued or students start new ones in high school. But these projects are really important part of the curriculum. They're designed to promote a student's ability to analyze complex issues, consider different points of view, make logical arguments and support claims using valid evidence, engage in civil discourse with those who hold opposing positions. So you see the really important view of understanding perspectives and really learning how to engage in discussions with people with different perspectives. And also to demonstrate understanding of the connections between federal, state, and local politics and policies, including issues that may impact the student's school or community. A very important part of this, though, which sometimes we really have to talk a lot about with teachers, and we are constantly getting guidance from the Department of Ed, and there's lots of seminars and workshops to help guide the civics project. And it's really important that we're goal-driven, for inquiry-based, the nonpartisan, which is really important. So we're a project would not, for example, have the students working on the electoral process or supporting a candidate. They might support a position or something that they're interested in, but it is supposed to be nonpartisan, which we support our teachers in helping them navigate that. And of course, the real world, and really there's the projects are student-led. So we give kids a variety of, not really options, but ideas, and then they just take it and they can run with it with the guidance of the teachers. Some of the eighth grade, there's two of the eighth grade projects I just wanted to highlight. There's so many, but one project that some of the teachers told me about was to a couple of students, either working groups or small groups, pairs, individual. I think this was a pair project. They worked on racism awareness. And their goal was to bring awareness to the problem of racism and the effects it has on different people. The students sold bracelets and donated $200 to the NAACP. And that was their project. So it's a project and then also something to have an outcome. Another project was students were raising awareness about the issues and stigma of teen suicide and the LGBTQIA+ community. The students Their goal was really to reduce stigma and to let kids know that they're not alone, the struggles they're facing even in their daily life. They made posters, posters around the school with resources for students to access if they were struggling. They also reached out to a local to one of the lawmakers about more mental health resources to really advocate for that. So as you can see, the projects are quite near and dear to their things that they're really concerned about. For history, right now we are in the process at the high school of selecting high quality United States history and world history textbooks. Our textbooks are aging, and the social studies department is working hard during department meeting time, and we're reaching out to a variety of publishers right now, and we are using a rubric from the Department of Ed to really make sure that the resources are high quality, and the purpose of tonight to really make sure, we'll talk a little bit more in another slide, but to really use a framework of diversity, equity, inclusion, to make sure we're looking to make sure the books and the texts and the resources are culturally proficient. We are planning our presentation tonight. Principal Hannah had mentioned a new class at the high school, which is called Race in American Society. And this course strives to promote an acceptance and respect for all peoples at Franklin High School, in Franklin and in the United States and around the world. And students, it's a semester course, and it's grounded in history and in order for students to learn understanding of the legacy of race in the United States. So the course is through the Social Studies Department, so it really is grounded in history. And students in this course, they also do a project, and they learn about multiculturalism, and they do a community service project, an ad campaign, they could attend lectures, they can read literature, do documentaries, they can visit museums. So it's really about expanding students' awareness and experience in multiculturalism through student-led and the ways that we're being now.
Thank you, Dr. Ashley. So one of the things that I want to highlight as it relates to the curriculum is the Seal of Biliteracy, which was put into place a couple of years ago. I think last year we graduated our first graduates with the seal in the class of 2021. It's a credential students may add to their high school transcript. It's endorsed by the Department of Education, so there's a formal process you have to go through in order to be a district that's allowed to award it. And this credential can be added to the transcript by a student demonstrating proficiency in English and a second language. So there are students for whom their first language is English, and they might earn the credential by taking a world language class like French or Spanish if they achieve a high enough proficiency level. It's also an opportunity to highlight the skills of English learners, who I think are so often thought of as limited or less than because they are acquiring English as a second language. But to me, this is really a celebration. I cannot speak two languages, and I would aspire to, I suppose. But it is really a celebration for our students who graduate biliterate in their home language and then also in English. Last year, like I said, we had our first graduates. There were four, and two of those students were English learners. Kudos to Dawn Marie Fernandez at the high school and Laura Evans for putting that program together.
On January 11th, Dr. Ellen White and Jen Greenland and I had the opportunity to share with you our continuing services that we offer here in Franklin in much detail, so I would not go into detail this evening, but those services for students with disabilities could include accommodations for students private gen ed teacher, inclusion support, support in the gen ed classroom, rephrasing that, support in the gen ed classroom by our paraprofessionals, related service providers, special educators, do some pull-up services, and then to our specialized programs, and then to out of district if they need it. And all these services are always based on student need, the individual student need. And of course, we always strive to, and we are obligated to provide these services in the new district environment, including the general education classroom. Kathy Giardina describes it best, and I just want to read her quote, is effective inclusion is about names and the uniqueness of every child. and not just the numbers or the test scores. It's about what the student needs and not the disability label often attached to the individual student. And effective inclusion is about the services provided rather than the places where those services are offered. And this is really what we strive for as educators, and really keep that in mind as we're developing a student's education, individualized educational plan. And you know, inclusion support and inclusive classrooms are beneficial to everyone, not just students with disabilities. They're beneficial to the staff and the students that are all around the students with disabilities. It really helps our students and staff really appreciate each individual's different cognitive processes and neurodiversity, and really just better understand that, you know, students learn in different, people learn in different ways. There's no one right way for thinking, learning, and behaving. And then all of these are differences, are not deficits, they're just differences. And we just really need to really appreciate each one of our differences and respect them.
Also related to curriculum and instruction, and something that I want to point out that I think is unique to Franklin Public Schools, it certainly has not existed in communities where I've worked previously, and that is the incredible support from our parent communication councils. They are, we had a meeting this evening, and I made sure to take a moment and note that they would be brought up as part of this presentation. Through their generous volunteerism and funding, they're providing enrichment and curriculum-based field trips. And I think what's really important is that this levels the playing field for families in terms of students being able to have access to enrichment and field trips in other districts. Field trips are often funded by individual families, and even though there may be financial support elsewhere, it's still a burden and a worry for families in order to afford those cultural expenses. And so curriculum-based field trips are funded by the PCCs. Now granted, there's volunteerism and fundraising behind all of that, but I think it's important to note those efforts. Core school supplies are provided by the district, and we participate with and are appreciative of the YMCA for the summer backpack program, where there's dozens of backpacks going out to students in the district before the start of school year.
Okay, can I piggyback on that comment around the YMCA? Mm-hmm. Mrs. Marano and I have a meeting set up for after February vacation. Our local YMCA is planning to expand their services for our community. We don't have all the detail now, but we'll certainly share that. But it's nice to hear that they're listening and learning and trying to see, looking for ways in which they can continue to support our community. So just to add, it wasn't really game time ready for the presentation, but certainly as that evolves and we have more info, we'll be sure to push that out.
And lastly, this last slide in the curriculum and instruction area is something that's being worked on by the subcommittee of the DEI committee. Linda can talk a little bit more about it.
It's such a wonderful committee. And we are really looking, which is very timely because we're starting to, as I talked about in a previous slide, we're really looking at history, text, and resources at the high school. So it was a really timely work with the committee. So we are researching lots of different rubrics and checklists to make sure that when we're looking and evaluating materials, that we're really looking very carefully for the culturally responsive lens, and as well as all the content. And the content and resources. So we're really looking for social studies history materials that present a diverse range of stories and experiences. We really want our students to apply a critical lens to the past. We're looking for materials that support students in connecting their learning to their own identity and experiences. So really making sure that there's writing opportunities, reading opportunities, and finding resources from a range of materials, and are also a great range of ways for our students to output their knowledge and learning. And we also look at materials that provide a diverse perspective, voices, and narratives, and also to encourage honest and informed discussions about power, prejudice, and oppression, which is important as we're looking for materials. And we'll use these rubrics for other subject areas as well, but right now it's time we're just looking at social studies.
Okay. The school culture is a big part of creating that safe and inclusive space, and this is going to touch upon those various ways.
So just two quick things. One, I'm reminded the next three slides are references to either core values, mission statements, and visions. And I'm going to harken back to my days as a young Marine, and I can remember a drill instructor talking about your core values are only as good as they're lived and anchor kind of the decisions you make. I think that would apply to a lot of different places, but the military certainly anchors their work around having a set of values that everyone can understand and can try to replicate and make decisions based on them. So when we put these up on the screen, I'm also reminded of, as a principal, during NEASC, you're required to really revisit, look at your core values, get stakeholder input, and put together a set of values that you as a community are willing to commit to. So when we think about that, the process that we've gone through with some of this work is really important. And I think it's demonstrated here with some of these examples. I'd also say that DEI, although we've always, as a school community, it's just inherent in what we do to want to be inclusive. And I feel like it's just, we've always shared an interest in really trying to foster inclusion, DEI in that work. But I think it has a renewed meaning as our students become more and more diverse. So we're really dedicated to that work. So here's just a few examples. From the elementary, wrong computer, okay. Here are some examples we pulled from sections. I didn't put the whole document because I really wanted to highlight where we see words that talk about having respect for differences, right? Respect for individual differences, cultures, kindness, and I think you see the ECDC wording at the bottom. Celebrate our diversity. And also you'll see examples of that at the high school as well, and really trying to build that idea around school culture. So like I said, these are values, and I hope that you've heard some concrete examples of where these shine through, and you'll continue to throughout the rest of the presentation.
So just some examples from the elementary level of ways that we build school culture. All of our classroom teachers and many of our special educators and specialists are trained in responsive classroom. So through morning meetings, closing circles, and throughout the day, we're striving to build that classroom community, give students authentic times to share and ask questions, and really get to know each other and to build that safe, welcoming environment for everyone. I believe all of our elementary schools have all school meetings on a monthly basis, where we will do any number of things related really to our core values. So they structured a little bit differently depending on the school and the community, but some examples that I can give you from Jefferson from the last several years, one of our core values is inclusive. So we have had all school meetings where we've shared information with students on topics such as dyslexia and autism. We have core values around safe and respectful. So we've done all school meetings around the importance of our names and using someone's, preferred name or nickname, pronouncing their name correctly and how it's a part of your identity. And then, getting at safe, how we act on the bus, expected versus unexpected behaviors, and throughout our school day, on the playground, in our hallways, that type of a thing. And also, taking a look at what's on the walls of our classrooms and our hallways and all of that. So Bren Badaklin, a mural artist who's been at many of our Franklin schools over the years, was just back at Jefferson for, I think this was the fifth time, and just painted a outstanding mural in the music room with input from all of our students during their art classes during his week of being an artist in residence. And we specifically worked to include musical instruments from all different cultures around the world. He just painted that parmenter as well. So those types of things are, what we're looking at, again, so that students see themselves reflected, but also, are learning.
Hello, I'm Craig Williams, the principal of Remington, and thank you for having me. I'm very excited to speak about what's happening in the middle level to build a culture of diversity, equity, and inclusion. All three middle schools are committed to the work of the World of Difference peer leaders. This was a group initiated in 2017-2018, but this year has allowed a real recommitment to training a group of around 20 students per school about bias and how they can address that and microaggressions that occur in our schools and community. The training is facilitated by a representative from ADL over a span of 3 days. In fact, we have two in-person trainings coming up where all three middle schools are going to be at the Horace Mann Auditorium receiving this training together. And then those peer leaders over the next few months will teach lessons to our sixth graders and provide resources for our schools to utilize.
All right, Craig, thanks so much, and good evening to the Franklin School Committee and community at large. In addition to the great work that's gone on at our elementary and middle schools, the high schools continue to find ways to connect with our students, making sure that the diverse backgrounds that we see in front of us every day are honored with the commitment that we have to updating our curriculum, creating opportunities for folks to see themselves and others in our daily interactions. We know that is the best way to allow for students to reach their optimal potential is to feel connected. And so that's where we're putting our energy. And as part of our school improvement goal, to make sure that we're seeing those moments in all of our lessons in our units. And I was in a math class earlier this week where one of our teachers was using geometric shapes and the idea of triangles and looking at food resources within certain communities in New England, and depending upon their socioeconomic status, how many opportunities that they have for more healthier foods versus maybe some fast food or convenience store type food. So we're not just seeing it in the humanities, we're seeing it in our STEM classes as well. But we know that that's not just the answer. We also recognize that we need to create resource groups and opportunities. In this past late fall, early winter into the new year, we teamed up with Akil Montesier, who works as a diversity, equity, inclusion specialist in the Bedford Public Schools. We brought him in on a number of occasions on Wednesday afternoons to create some opportunity for small groups of folks who have either identified within our clubs or within our school as not feeling as connected with the community as we would hope, and really working to get some of our stories out into the floor and into the voices and ears and understandings within our school. And we're going to be bringing I Can statements for members of these resource groups to a faculty meeting in March, where our faculty can hear some of the reality. Because as dedicated as we are to the work, and as much improvement as we've seen, not just here in Franklin, but across the state in the last 5 or 3 years, we know there's still work to be done. We need to hear these stories so we can allow for it to motivate us to work.
And in seeing the success of the resource group at the high school, the middle level is exploring ways we can translate that success and that type of a program in a developmentally appropriate way for our middle schoolers.
I think we're moving to the next slide. I'm having trouble. Yes. I'm not sure what the school committee can hear, but we'll go with it.
There it is.
So, school culture-wise, we're on. Okay, Craig, I think you're going with Best Buddies. Is that right?
Yes, I got that. So, all levels are aiming to include a variety of club and extracurricular offerings that will promote inclusion. They include Best Buddies, Spectrums and Saga, which promote positive awareness of our LGBTQIA plus community, the Diversity Awareness Club at the high school, as well as Girl Up. So plenty of opportunities if students want to bring this after school, these passions to help promote and make sure that everyone feels a sense of belonging, a home at the schools in Franklin.
Yeah, I agree, Craig, and I think folks that, you know, experience a week at the high school recognize that no matter where your interests are, there's opportunity for you to explore your passion. And the clubs there on the list are fine examples of that. But I would have, I think, you know, bulleting out Unified Sports as arguably the most inclusive organization to hit Massachusetts in the last 20 years. It is an absolute highlight of our school, our entire school system, and certainly for Franklin High School, it's a point of tremendous pride. More recently, we were honored by being welcomed to the Unified Games down in Florida, and I know that there was support by the school committee, which we thank you for that, because as we look at how to create an equitable, inclusive community, there's no better way than to see, we have evidence of it, than to see it in action. And the work that our athletes and coaches within our Unified Sports programs connect with each other in the sincere joy and collective support is absolutely second to none. Any administrator who's been a part of it, recognizing that this is a real piece of evidence to support the hard work that goes into this type of program. So thank you to all of the coaches and adults to help support. A special shout out to our athletic director, Mr. Tom Angelo, who I know played a gigantic role in beginning the Unified Sports here within the Franklin Public Schools.
And in addition to that, Lisa Berger, who's one of the coaches, is working very hard to get this up and moving at the middle level. So we're very excited for that opportunity, just knowing the power that it can have.
This next slide, we don't necessarily watch the entire video, but for the school committee members who haven't tuned in to the Panther News lately, this particular creation was helping us kick off our Franklin High School No Place for Hate campaign, where we connected the Anti-Defamation League to really call out some opportunities for us as a community to say we've seen examples of things that aren't okay. We've seen examples of hate speech, harassment, bullying, etc. And sadly, in particular, in the last, coming out of the pandemic, we've noticed a opportunity for us to realize some of our behaviors that maybe we weren't getting redirected enough during the pandemic were being seen and heard, and that's not okay. And as a school, we committed to working with the Anti-Defamation League to come up with a kind of overall outline to help support some of the work. And so we kicked the campaign off the days following Martin Luther King weekend, where we really felt as though his memory was a great way to surround this idea of creating equality for all and making sure that not only do we believe in that, but we act in it. And we collected over 1,200 signatures just in the hallway without any coercion. That was one of the most important parts of this program, was to really create this opportunity for students to show their want to connect. And some of the school committee members were gracious enough to join and see. And it's just like any movement, it started slow, and as the week wore on and their understanding of the program wore on, it gained more and more support. It allowed for us to organize around now making opportunities in March, April, and May, three different school-wide opportunities to show our commitment to making Franklin High School a no place for hate, which I think we all agree with. And now it's an opportunity for us to showcase that, particularly for groups that maybe have seen, heard, or felt not as supported as we have as our standard. As Mr. Jabir was mentioning, your core values are only as strong as the way in which you live them. And we have had examples where we were not living up to them, and that's not okay. And this campaign is gonna help us call that out and move forward. And we have plans for incorporating an advisory program back into the high school schedule for next year, where we can continue to follow up on these points and these missions on a more consistent basis.
Hi everyone, we've got a special show for you today, but first, here are a few school announcements. The Red Grass Club is hosting a movie night next Friday in
the Friday.
What we do is share that.
It's from the link is provided, you may have seen it.
Okay.
Linda and I from Central Office have been promoting in the schools an awareness related to holidays as well as months of recognition using a calendar published by the Anti-Defamation League.
Linda may want to add a little bit more about that.
So we have been really trying to look at making sure we're more inclusive of holidays, but also making sure that we don't just think about Black History Month in the month of February, or it's really important to embed our teaching and learning throughout our curriculum and throughout the year. But principals and teachers do a great job of highlighting different holidays, different cultural events, through a variety of celebrations. It's also, we realize it's really important to ask our students, and we have some students on our on the DEI committee, which is wonderful. And they, one of the students reminded us during one of our meetings that it's really important to kind of ask the students, ask the families, you know, how do you celebrate the culture? What are some books, what are some books that would be good to read? And to really ask and learn together if it's a culture that we might not know that much about. So I think that was a really important bit of advice from one of our high school students. It's just like, you know, that book really isn't that great about our culture. How about this book? So I think we all have lots of learning to do together. But some of the things that in the elementary schools, they're doing like Fun Fact Fridays, where they talk about Veterans Day, Hispanic Heritage Month, or other celebrations. Principals are talking about things in newsletters, bulletin boards from around the school. So really trying to be much more inclusive of our awareness of recognition.
For viewing later, you can watch a student production related to Juneteenth. And a little bit more about school culture is gathering data about how the students are feeling in the culture. So Kristen is going to start us off with the Metro West Youth Risk Behavior Survey.
Thank you. So as many of you are aware, we participate in the Metro West Adolescent Health Survey every other year. Franklin joined the initiative in 2006, and we have longitudinal data from 2006 up through almost today. Our most recent data is from 2018, which is pre-pandemic, so we're at a little bit of a loss coming here to present to you today because we don't have the data from 2021. We should have surveyed students in grades 7 through 12 in 2020, but due to the pandemic, they bumped it back a year. So we surveyed students at the middle and high school level in October and November of 2021. So we're still waiting for our data, but I do want to share with you the most recent data from 2018 with you tonight. So the survey asked students questions about verbal harassment, and students can identify themselves by race, ethnicity, culture, sexual orientation, gender identity, disability, height, weight, and how they look. More students report bullying due to their height and weight more than any other group within our schools. In 2016, this is when a lot of this data started to be collected. But the next group would be students identifying verbal harassment and bullying due to their race, ethnicity, or culture at both the high school and middle school level. So people who identified themselves as females at the middle school level, 32% of them said that they have been bullied due to height and weight or how they look, whereas 27% of males have said they've been bullied for the same reason, and 10% of all students said at the middle level said they've been bullied due to their race, ethnicity, or culture. At the high school level, people who identified themselves as female, 30% of them said that they had been bullied due to their height, weight, or how they look. 25% of those students who identified as male said that they had been bullied for the same reasons. 8% of all high school students said that they had been bullied due to their race, ethnicity, and or culture. And more students in ninth grade, 36%, and it starts to decrease by grade level, so 30% in 10th grade, 25% in 11th grade, and 18% in 12th grade said that they had been bullied due to their height, weight, or how they look. So I just wanted to give you the breakdown by grade level. So it did seem to go down in terms of percentage, but still these are quite shocking numbers. The survey also asks questions related to stress, and people who identified as female responded to the question, how often do you worry or feel stressed about your appearance? At the high school level, 47% of those identifying as female said that they feel stressed for those reasons. 15% of those identifying as males said that they felt stressed. At the middle level, people identifying as female said 38% of the time they worry or feel stressed about their appearance, and 11% of those identifying as male said they were stressed for those reasons. 27% of ninth graders, 29% of 10th graders, 40% of 11th graders, 30% of 12th graders report worrying or feeling stressed about their appearance. So this is just to give you a little bit of insight into some of the things that our students are reporting. And Franklin is one of 28 schools within the Metro West region that participates. And one of our, in 2021, approximately 41,000 students in the Metro West region participated in the survey. So as I said at the beginning, we are looking forward to our 2021 data.
Thank you, Kristen. I think we're kind of behind, so to speak, when I think about not having 2020 data and having gone 3 years through the pandemic with everything that's gone on. So we are looking forward to the 2021 data. The survey was taken this fall, and so I think we should expect some data later this spring. We'll also get some comparative data too against other similar communities in the region, give us a sense of Franklin versus other communities. And Kristen, among others, including our guidance counselors and administrators, always use the information and make changes into the health and wellness curriculum and into some of the other instructional practices in the school to address not just what you heard, but there would also be other questions about substance use and vaping and things of that nature. Because the Metro West Youth Risk Behavior Survey is every other year, typically, we are exploring an additional tool which could be given 3-4 times a year. I don't know that we would, but the Panorama Student Survey is an option that we are exploring. We'd actually thought about doing it in December, but the I don't mean to be critical, the questions that Panorama had for us, including feelings of belonging, culture, and diversity, were excellent. But we are working a little bit more with the company to add some questions related to LGBTQIA+. And so once we have a survey that I think reflects our broader view of diversity, we'll put something out that can be repeated over time to get more timely data on how our students are. So part of school culture is also unfortunately responding to bias-based incidents that arise. I think as educators, we are in kind of a prime position to use those as important opportunities that need to be addressed. And so Lucas is going to talk a little bit about that.
So there's some statistical data for you looking back in 2017, 2018, the number of investigations that took place with the bullying findings and civil rights findings. As we move through 18 to 19, we saw a decrease. And then I will say the pandemic years, we saw a significant decrease, but we don't believe it's consistent with the data that previously existed. This year, we're about three quarters of the way, actually we're halfway through the year, and we're at 60 investigations that have taken place with bullying findings and civil rights violations findings as well. So we're seeing an increase. I think you've heard this before around the uptick in student behavior resulting in investigations, but certainly it's an area that when we do investigate, there's two lenses we need to apply. A lens to the specific incident and who was harmed individually, who was identified as an aggressor, and what type of training and education do they need? And then we have to also take a step back and say, how does this look across our culture in our schools and in our buildings? But I think our administrators, for all of the hats they wear, we've talked about multiple areas in which we're trying to move this work forward tonight. We've talked about some of the proactive places, curriculum, instruction. But I will say this takes a lot of time. A good investigation takes time, and it takes a lot of communication with all parties and to really do the work to do the fact finding. There's some three main areas we'll hit on in this particular topic. Policies. So we have policies like all the school districts across Massachusetts, really across the country, specifically bullying prevention and intervention. We have a bullying policy that's under review with our policy subcommittee currently to look at updates. We've looked at models. I think that was referenced last meeting with an update from Mr. Callahan, and we'll continue to see that. From there, we have a bullying prevention and intervention plan. The plan really is predicated on having that policy updated, so folks can expect a revisit to that. I think I would imagine that we would want to share some of those updates more broadly, and also have a communication strategy for how we get that information out to families around bullying and that policy and plan. So until the policy is established, it doesn't make sense to change the plan until we know that the policy is locked in. We have non-discrimination, harassment, and sexual harassment policies as well, like every district in Massachusetts. So with regard to procedures for investigating, there are mechanisms for reporting. We've mentioned this before, but a student could report it directly to an adult. We could receive email information, a parent could reach out. We also have an online bullying form. You go to the Franklin Public Schools website and about us, you'll see a section called bullying prevention and intervention, and then right there is an anonymous reporting form that folks can fill out. So when those reports come in, when we identify a reported or alleged victim at that moment, we really try to focus on what are the supportive measures or interim supports, depending on the situation, the supportive measures that the student needs in that moment. So that can range, and typically it's a personal conversation between an administrator, a family, and the student around what they need to feel safe while an investigation would take place. The second piece is really setting up the interviews, and we've been trained, our whole administrative staff has been trained on investigations, but our attorneys who do those trainings have provided us with a flowchart, which really walks through, you know, what steps we need to take, who needs to be interviewed, and making sure that we've put in places safety measures in place along the way to try to get to seek the truth and get to the bottom of some of the behaviors that are reported, which include interviews, as you can see there. And then ultimately, when there's a finding or not a finding, depending on the situation, we arrive and communicate out with parties where we landed with that investigation. In all cases, there's opportunities to learn, whether it's paired with a consequence in some cases based on the behavior. There's always an opportunity to get some training and some education. And then, as I said, if I was to take a step back, we try to look at situations that maybe happen to individuals, but what's the context that's happening within the school, the classroom, the grade, to make sure that we're really mindful of that. We use a standard template form really to guide how these take place, the investigations take place, to make sure we're covering bases. And we're examining what we're learning when we have, you know, a preponderance of evidence, or it's determined that it's more than likely to occur. Do we have the information we need to kind of make that determination? System of documentation and tracking. So when a report is finalized, it's shared with our central office, and we track and monitor on what types of categories findings are happening or not finding, or if there's no finding. And then ultimately, safety and support plans are developed in cases where there's a target or a victim, to make sure that they feel safe and supported, depending on the scenario. And then one piece here on opportunities for healing. Sometimes there are incidents that occur and it's a community that's impacted. So I've talked a little bit about kind of individuals and looking at a school, but unfortunately there are situations that become more hurtful and kind of extend beyond maybe an individual and really hit a community. And we try to look at how are there ways that we can partner with our community organizations, with our schools, band together as districts and levels and whatnot. I think of some of the work with the Franklin Freedom Team, which part of the mission is around trying to support healing within a community. So those are just a couple of examples in that way. And then a note about communication. There are times where information is communicated, but there's also times where there's privacy involved. So we try, just like with anything, we try to be as transparent as possible, but there are situations just like, or, you know, if you're a parent and it's your child who's either a victim or an aggressor, there are certain rights that you have along that, around privacy. And we also try to look at, everyone's trying to navigate school as a student. You try to navigate every grade and different behaviors arise, but ultimately we work with kids and we're an industry that has kids. And we owe it to our victims to make sure that we decrease that over time and try to make them feel safe and create psychologically safe environments across our school. But we also owe it to our aggressors in these situations where they've made an inappropriate behavior to hold them accountable, but also teach them and give them a way to come back into the community and learn from their mistake to try to do that. So those are just some of the focus areas, I'd say. And just a shout out to our administrators. I don't know if it's really truly understood the day that what it entails and the amount of time our administrators dedicate to try to seek the truth and communicate. And these are not, this particular topic and area is not the fun part of the job when you go into education and you want to work in schools. It's certainly an area where it can come with a host of challenges. And communicating with the victim's family or an aggressor's family on two different sides sometimes of a coin, you really have to do what you believe is right in the situation and use the information you have to make a decision. So I just would give a shout out to our administrators who have to manage this and try to keep a culture together in a school that has a variety of behaviors happening, positive and unfortunately negative. So I think I'll stop there.
Thank you. Thanks, Lucas.
Sure.
And our response protocol has been developed by, I don't know if you, I thought I maybe saw you bring it, responding to incidents of hate and bias, which is from
teaching
tolerance, learning for justice.
Learning for justice, thank you. They put out a whole manual. And that's where the Speak Up at School that we referenced a few times tonight, and you saw the yellow resource. It's included with this as a strategy that you can use within your school, but they provided that work, so.
Great. And kind of rounding out the presentation is just some district supports, whether they're in place or in process, to kind of uphold these efforts that you've heard about this evening. We've posted for the Director of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion, and we anticipate that with a slate of candidates, we can begin interviewing in March. A few of us as a team are participating on the Educator Diversification Professional Learning Community with the Department of Education. There are monthly meetings to develop a comprehensive recruitment and retention strategy along the lines of diversifying our educator workforce. As I noted, this is very impactful in terms of student learning outcomes, and I think it would enrich our entire community. There are about 100 districts participating, and there is potential grant funding available to provide supports and incentives in diversifying an educator workforce. One of the things that I think has gone perhaps maybe a little bit unknown or unnoticed in terms of our budget allocations, I think it's worth mentioning in a kind of comprehensive view on how the district is approaching diversity, equity, and inclusion. But when site-based monies are allocated out to our schools, when we have crafted the school department's budget, Miriam and I have allocated based on free and reduced lunch percentages. And so the funding across up to schools does weigh in on the economic impacts. And we have regularly, over the past couple of years, had conversations with the DPCCs around equity in funding to make sure that there's equitable learning experiences across schools at the same level. On the next slide, we are getting an equity audit underway, and we should have more information to come out to the community, I would say, within the next week or so. We are working with a public consulting group after an RFP process has been selected to conduct an external review of the district's efforts towards diversity, equity, and inclusion. I think it's really important to have that third-party external view in terms of all of these things that we're looking to do. We also want to look to be better. They will also take a scientific look at some of our data from publicly available sites like the Department of Education or some information that we provide to them to kind of match the learning experiences and learning outcomes with some of our efforts. So it's both a quantitative and a qualitative review. They will be conducting focus groups to gather that qualitative information. And you can expect this to be done over the next several months with a report in May. Ultimately, the information will be used to prioritize and drive some longer-term goals and to maybe hone in on certain areas of the work as higher leverage, depending upon what the data and the trends are showing. This data analysis complements what we already participate in, and so again, things that may be a little hidden and unknown to the general public is that every 6 years we participate in a statewide review of tiered focused monitoring, which includes civil rights, English learning, and special education, and our compliance as well as outcomes related to special populations. And then I think it's every 2 years we're currently in the process, and it's almost done, with the U.S. Department of Education submit data related to civil rights. It includes things like discipline. It includes things like advanced course taking, broken down by some groups to see if there's any disproportionality in the districts, in our work. So that is also in the works currently as part of our regular activities. And then, of course, I want to be sure to acknowledge our Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Committee. We meet monthly. We meet tomorrow. And we have 6 subcommittees. We have 1 subcommittee. Some of what you heard tonight is the ways in which the subcommittees are kind of broken up. But we have 1 subcommittee working on curriculum and instruction. And like you heard, supporting educators and principals on identifying anti-bias or addressing bias within materials. We have a group that's expanding upon staff recruitment and retention, looking at our selection process and interview process and making some recommendations there. We have a professional development group. We recently put out some ideas for principals to use with faculty at faculty meetings. So just kind of teeing up some ready resources that have been vetted and identified as being consistent with our goals and values that principals can use with their faculty. And one of the things that I will say about this administrative team is that they create those resources and will put them into place. So that is something that I regularly see within the district. The policies and practices group has been working towards creating a more welcoming school environment, both in person and online, as families enroll. School handbooks, you can expect to see more there. Our school culture group surveyed principals and assistant principals to find out more about what would be helpful to them. And the communication group is looking to communicate efforts around diversity, equity, and inclusion, particularly from the committee. Similar to the professional development group, the inclusive practices group is looking to provide some supportive resources to get out to principals and assistant principals and faculty as we support students of all neurodiverse types in our classrooms. Oh, that should have been deleted. One last slide to talk about. So in sum, I hope we've demonstrated through this our efforts towards listening, learning, acting, and reflecting. As I know, I don't think we pretend to have all the answers. I think we are looking to create inclusive, equitable learning spaces for each and every child, and doing so together with our community, with humility and a growth mindset. And I also would just add too, I think the last thing that I would want anyone to take away from this is that we are striving to be divisive. And in fact, I think our efforts are looking to pull people together to be one community focused on Franklin's culture to graduate and our values. So with that, well, sorry if we've been long-winded. We'll be happy to take questions about this.
Thank you very much, Dr. Irvin. We'll go down the line. Camille, any questions, comments?
Yes. This isn't really a question because I don't think we could tease out the answer, but I wonder if the increase in bullying incidents is more comfort in sharing that they happened, necessarily that they are happening more often. And I'd like to think that is true, but I also don't want to sugarcoat anything. I'm glad that we're addressing that. But I do think kids they've gone through the curriculum that we've put in place for years about being an upstander, and so I think they're more likely to report those incidents. I was happy to hear about primary source helping teachers facilitate those difficult discussions, because as a teacher, I can tell you that students learn through practice, and teachers need practice too. They aren't always trained in those facilitating those discussions. They're not always naturally comfortable with them. And it's like sports. I don't really understand why people get it with sports. They get it with an instrument, but difficult conversations are something that people have to practice. It takes a long time to be effective in dialogue and discussion. Mistakes are expected, setbacks too, and some people are just naturally more skilled. We hear a lot, including from some of the citizen comments tonight, that there's a chasm in our society, that there's a divide in our country, but very seldom are real solutions put forth. Although I will note that the mother and teacher was the one that proposed some positive actions that we could take. But I do think that if we're ever to bridge that gap, it is having these types of difficult conversations in the classroom that is the only way, not the only way, it is the best way to help our future and our kids. And the kids are absolutely willing to do it. And it's particularly important if the adults around them are unwilling, unable to discuss difficult topics with appropriate context or information, or to discuss these with respect and empathy. And it may be that they haven't had opportunities or exposure to these subjects before, so they themselves need the practice. And without these opportunities, we are hindering our students as they leave Franklin High School. They're gonna go into a world that is not gonna be very forgiving of their inability to discuss difficult topics, to be creative, and to respect other people. I think it's important too, and it makes me excited to see all the efforts to increase exposure to the diverse voices and diverse stories. And those of my generation know that a lot of our education of other races or identities was either tokenism or it was seen through just through oppression. I know that my history, I wasn't too interested in history in high school because it was all treaties and wars. And it wasn't until college that I was like, oh my God, women were doing cool things all during those 400, 500 years, thousands of years. Whether it's in the books that students read or the history they learn or the faculty and staff that they see in front of them or the opportunities that they have to interact with different people, it's important that they see diversity precisely so they can see the universality of humans' experiences and that they can be connected to other humans. That's actually the secret. The more you learn about somebody's differences, the more you see the commonalities that they have with you, a human being. So I'd actually like to share one of my favorite quotes, if I could. It's one that I came across in high school, and it helped explain for me why I love to read. I actually have a tattoo that says read. It's much less crisp than it was 20 years ago, but kids can still read it. I'm a product of a challenging childhood that nevertheless was filled with privilege. But books helped me escape, and they also gave me a different perspective and different options into my future. So this quote is from James Baldwin, activist and writer. You think your pain and your heartbreak are unprecedented in the history of the world, but then you read. It was books that taught me that the things that tormented me most were the very things that connected me with all the people who were alive, who had ever been alive. Thank you.
Thank you. Dave
Kelly? Yeah, absolutely. I want to begin thanking everybody, Ms. Flynn, Ms. Latinda Smith, Mr. Williams, Mr. Hanna, Dr. Ashley, the entire central office staff for putting together this incredibly robust presentation. Each session that we have, I'm always amazed and impressed at what is being done within our district, and incredibly proud to be able to live here, to spend my tax dollars here, to send my kids to these schools. The work that you're doing is tremendous and amazing, and I know not easy, but thank you so much for our teachers, for our administrators, for everybody involved for doing this work. And a few kind of comments as well. One, I love that the portrait of a graduate is a thread throughout this presentation, throughout so many other presentations that we have, that it's always something that we live to, that we work and strive for. At one point too, there was a quote that we try to globalize what students are learning. And I absolutely love that, to really be able to teach the lessons, but also there was the specific slide was done in terms of like PE activities, but that, you know, all this information that the students are learning isn't just being taught within a vacuum, but there's so much context that's behind it. We had just a few sessions ago, one of our pledge students, she during the introduction talked about how she is now doing archery. And that she got introduced to archery because in PE class they were doing archery and they were combining it with learning about the Hunger Games, reading about the Hunger Games. And it was fantastic, and it was that stickiness that really kind of then made her jump to that next level to say, I love this and I want to be able to pursue this. And it's fantastic to see that. I loved that line, the globalizing what students are learning. I also want to comment too about the civics project. It's fantastic to hear about. One of the huge duties that we have is to make sure that all of our students are well educated and engaged citizens by the time that they are graduating. And we're clearly striving to do what we can to that end when it comes to the civics projects. If there's anything too for those students that are embarking or that are doing it in the future, if we can help at the school committee level, if you want to present any of your projects to us, at our meeting, presenting to a larger audience, I'd be in favor of it. I don't speak for the entire committee, but please reach out to us. And lastly, too, I wanted to hit on what Ms. Clem had introduced, talking about the windows and the mirrors. And it is so valuable, and I'm so glad to hear that we're continuing to kind of push that within all of our libraries, K-12, because it is so valuable for both for students to be able to see themselves in the books that they read, even in the superhero movies that they watch. It gives that sense of empowerment, and the windows concept too seems more and more important that all of us and the children included have a wider access to the world around them and a better understanding that that their world isn't the only world, that they live in a much larger universe, and to be able to introduce books that do exactly that is a wonderful, wonderful jumping off platform. So I'm so thrilled that we're continuing to pursue that as well. So really, thank you so much for all the work that everyone's doing. It's fantastic.
Al?
Yep. So first and foremost, thank you. Appreciate this presentation. I know it took us maybe a little over an hour, but I can't imagine how many hours it took me to prepare this together. It just shows your dedication, your passion around this, and you're really committed to DE&I. the things that jumped out at me that I wanted to commend you all for is just really taking the approach of you don't know what you don't know, and really having that open mindset that if something does come up, you are flexible, you are changing, and you are accommodating for the needs of our students. I think that's the most important thing. It sets the right behaviors for our students to see and really model and adapt as well. It's key in life, because you can't just be the same as you are as a child. You'll never change, you'll never improve, you'll never grow if you don't step outside of the comfort zone. When it comes to the resource groups, I was heartened that you're expanding it beyond high school and bringing it down to the middle level. I think that's key. Our middle students are in that weird, unique position, and I think they need it as much as our high school folks do, so putting that energy and effort into that is ideal. And then lastly, Paula, I love your energy about where your students are and really making sure that they feel inclusive and they are brought in and they're not separate from our other students, because they're all our students and they all should work together, because they're going to work together outside of school as well. So thank you for the dedication there. Much appreciated. Other than that, thank you, folks. It's great.
Okay. Yeah, thank you all for all the work you did putting this together. This was fantastic. I think it says a lot about the values of Franklin Public Schools, but as well as the values of our community, that we want to learn, we want to do better, we want to make sure that our public school system is open, inclusive, and diverse as we can possibly make it. And we talk a lot in this country about American exceptionalism. I can't think of anything that makes us exceptional more than our diversity. And I think that we have that as a core value of, as was mentioned before by other members, acknowledging what we don't know, but also looking to improve. I think that's fantastic. I do have a couple questions. Please, any panelists, feel free to chime in who feels appropriate to answer. The financial assistance policy, I think that was mentioned in regards to from the reduced lunch. Can we maybe just expand a little bit on that? What does that entail?
I'm going to turn it to Miriam. She wasn't a panelist, but I think she would be a great person to respond. She actually was really critical in terms of developing this policy.
Thank you. So the financial assistance policy allows families to apply for additional financial assistance for some of our fee-based programs. The policy is outlined on our website in the finance department with the application. Generally, the majority of applications we see typically have applied towards preschool tuition, which we offer an opportunity for families to pay a portion or a reduced rate based on their income tier structure. We also offer some additional financial assistance for transportation if families don't qualify for free or reduced meals, which automatically waives the fee for transportation. There might be an additional reduction in a transportation fee, because depending on their income level as well. We are also exploring some fee waivers for our solutions, sorry, not our solutions program, but our lifelong learning programs, private music lessons, community learning potentially, but we are exploring that as well. I guess. So that gives opportunities for families to participate in some of the fee-based programs, as well as some of the activities that might be going on at the building level for student activities, and gives principals the flexibility if there's funding available to apply the policy to certain other events as well.
Oh, absolutely, thank you. And that slide mentioning of how the proportion of student population on free and reduced lunch having been increasing, using that as a metric of socioeconomic status, I think it's fantastic that we have this financial assistance policy in place to be able to ensure that all students have access to our services, because we certainly wouldn't want anyone to be excluded based on that. So I think that's wonderful that we're valuing that as well. And then from the next thing, maybe similar, on the homework policy, what does that entail? How is that kind of been used to help students have more equitable access to homework support?
So I can start. The homework policy was reviewed in 2017 into the 17 and 18 school year. After a lot of deliberation and a lot of discussion between the policy subcommittee, members of the community, and then here at the whole school committee. I think in terms of recognizing, there were a couple of things at play in terms of the homework policy. One was related to kind of homework as educationally sound and developmentally appropriate, and trying to tackle and answer some questions there, given the age of students and how the previous policy that I never worked within, when I came on board, it was sort of in the process of already having been revised, but it was kind of very, I think, tightly prescribed and scripted in terms of numbers of minutes that could be expected. There aren't the same opportunities in every household to have support with homework. Homework might be expected to have financial contributions from families for specific projects, so that's something that we've been as a district moving away from and have concerns about. So the homework policy aims to kind of, it's not that homework is completely gone, we still have homework, but it needs to be tied very directly to furthering an educational outcome. The student needs to be familiar and aware of what they need to do prior to attempting that homework, and really ought not to involve or require a lot of parent or guardian support so that students can be independent. Again, recognizing that there's such a thing as a homework gap, and we want to make sure that everybody has the opportunity to complete what they need to complete outside of school.
Yeah, thank you for elaborating on that. We know how much socioeconomic status can correlate with there's both educational success and other success in life, and so making sure that we can do everything we can to have all students be able to succeed at homework and have the educational team in the classroom. And I think it's really grassroots-based level here that we can provide that assistance for. I think that's absolutely fantastic, so thank you for sharing that with us. Another thing, so when we talk about cultural proficiency and kind of learning about cultural proficiency with the teachers and students, are we, and I know Principal Hannah mentions the resource groups, but are there maybe formalized events or listening sessions dedicated to cultural proficiency, or is that more something that teachers kind of incorporate on their own?
So Mr. Hanna is planning a formal listening event for the students in the resource group who've been working with Mr. M to share their voices with the faculty and staff. So that's kind of one element of that. There have been other opportunities. I know at the high school, remind a couple of years ago, members of the Diversity Awareness Club presented at a faculty meeting and shared some stories at the faculty meeting. It was very, very powerful to have, and I know that that's happened actually at a couple of other individual faculty meetings as well. In terms of working towards cultural proficiency, there's been a few district professional development opportunities. Teachers, when they're applying for course reimbursement, some are taking some graduate courses that are related to anti-bias education or culturally proficient skill development. So I think it's happening in a multitude of ways. I think I would aspire to have a course for Franklin Public Schools teachers that is being run that goes into more depth, where there's cohorts of teachers taking a course on an annual basis as part of our formal professional development program, but that's kind of a goal or an aspiration at this point.
Excellent, thank you. And then one last question. Regarding the educator diversification recruitment strategy, so the development of that strategy, is there a timeline or plan for a strategy to be developed, or is that will that be incorporated into the recommendations of the equity audit?
So I could see it being both. So the professional learning community will be completed, I think in May perhaps, and they're working us through kind of a workbook to develop some of those strategies, and then some further recommendations. There are some things that we put into place already, but I think one of the big takeaways that I have from the professional learning community is to really be thinking comprehensively about both the recruitment and the selection, but also retention and support. And so wanting to be sure that we're kind of thinking about it comprehensively. So the plan and recommendations will kind of come from the professional learning communities, the small group of us that's working, including Lisa Trainer, our director of HR. And I imagine the equity audit may have some findings and some recommendations based on what we know from our data.
Absolutely. Yeah, thank you. That sounds to me very valuable, and the recommendations of the front end of that, because you mentioned the importance of students having educators that look like them, but also the importance of students having educators that don't look like them, being able to have exposure to all other cultural backgrounds that they otherwise may not have exposure to. That's a lot. I think that's also extremely valuable to put forward our stated goals of diversity, equity, and inclusion in our students and the values that we are sending Franklin students out to the world. So thank you so much. Thank you all for the hard work you put together on this presentation.
Elise? This was such a jam-packed presentation. There was so much in here, and I just want to share, as my colleagues, deep, deep gratitude to all the presenters, to all of you for putting this all together, for taking your time with it tonight and really being very thoughtful in your presentation, much appreciated. And I love having the books here. I feel like we're in a classroom. I did just one word of kudos. I wanted to just express my gratitude, especially that many of you echoed the humble disclaimer that the district still has a ways to go. And we all know that the journey of continuous improvement is never finished. It's all about doing better once we know better. And I really appreciated hearing that a number of times tonight. So thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks very much for the presentation. I'd like to echo the comments from my school committee members. And I was really impressed with the depth and thoroughness of the presentation and the initiatives in our district. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you everyone again. I know that 9:30. We're only on item number 2 of the agenda. But this was amazing. And Dr. Ahern's been promising this presentation for a while, so thank you so very much. Very quickly, I noticed Dr. Ahern had mentioned that the English learner population increased by 50%. Are we planning for these needs moving forward? Okay. So
yes.
Building that into the budget.
I think you can expect there to be some requests in the superintendent's recommended budget related to our English learners.
And I know that I brought this up when Dr. Edwards first brought up the whole civics project. I was really looking to see the presentation to students. I was very excited. Just if we could make it sometime.
Yeah, it's definitely on the list. They're not ready at this moment, but it is on the list to invite some students in to present their civics projects.
Yeah. All right, thank you. The online bullying form, where does that go? Is it that there's like, oh,
so.
Okay. So like when you go to the form, you have to say like what school it is, and it goes to the admin. Okay.
There's a workflow that it goes to the correct school just for privacy, so that people know that the information they had goes, so it doesn't go to a whole group. It's who you select, and it moves. I do believe, Dr. Hurd, are you copied on those as superintendent?
I am.
Okay.
Thank you very much. I just
want
to say that all of our staff that are here tonight for this very long presentation, that we see you and we appreciate all of your service and dedication to our children and your students. So thank you all so very much. I wish more people stuck around to watch the presentation because it was really, really insightful. So will this be available for us to share?
So the video, we could probably see if we can clip it and have it as a standalone presentation.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
you, everyone.
Do you want to grab the books? We are now producing this in collaboration with Franklin TV and Franklin Public Radio. This podcast is my public service effort for Franklin, but we can't do it alone. We can always use your help. How can you help? If you can use the information that you find here, please tell your friends and neighbors. If you don't like something here, please let me know. Through this feedback loop, we can continue to make improvements. And I thank you for listening. For additional information, please visit franklinmatters.org. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me directly at suresteve@gmail.com. The music for the intro and exit was provided by Michael Clark and the group East of Shirley. The piece is titled Ernesto Mañana, copyright Michael Clark and Tin Type Tunes in 2008, and used with their permission. I hope you enjoy. By the way, you can also subscribe and listen to Franklin Matters Radio on your favorite podcast app. Search in podcasts for Franklin Matters.